Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, hopefully we're starting, but my stupid switchboard is having a hissy fit right now. Apologize to everybody. Hopefully this works.
Welcome to Somewhere in Vegas on blogtalkradio.com. I'm Mark the Q. I'm your host. We're starting a new series called Throwback Thursdays, where we'll revisit interviews over our past seven-year history of the show. Today we're heading back to December 3rd, 2013, and our interview with comedian Sylvia Traymore Morrison. 40 years ago, a little show called SNL started on NBC, and Morrison was a big part of it. A writer for the initial season, she broke barriers to the first African-American female writer on the hit show, something that wouldn't happen again for at least a couple decades. Morrison talked to us about being behind the scenes of SNL back in the day and regales us on opening for Whitney Houston, who had just died before the interview aired. She also talked about roasting Muhammad Ali and her book, Almost There.
So I'm very privileged to have a longtime comedian and impressionist. She actually was a writer for Saturday Night Live. She's still going strong. She has a new book that just came out as well. I am very privileged to have Sylvia Traymore Morrison on with us right now. How are you doing, Sylvia?
Hey, Mark, how are you? Thanks for having me.
No, not a problem at all. I mean, when I started reading about, you know, some of your exploits and some of the things that you've done, it's been, you have had a really kind of a very successful career.
Yeah, it's been quite a ride. It really has, I have to admit. Considering what I do and all that's happened down through the years, I've never even thought about it until in the last couple of years people started calling me from all over the world saying, wait a minute, where have you been? Who are you? How come we don't really know you? And that kind of stuff. So,
first of all, let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you get started in comedy and doing impressions?
Well, you know, Mark, when I was a little girl, I mean little, like 3 or 4 years old, I could hear things. I could hear the flap of a butterfly's wing. I could hear a bumblebee on its approach to the area where we were. I could hear and understand the song of a cricket. And not only could I hear them, I could make their sounds. And this was when I was just a little girl. One day I realized I could imitate my neighbors. I could imitate people on the street. I would have the whole neighborhood laughing by imitating some of the neighbors. And so it was no problem once I started watching television regularly to do imitations of people on television. And the next thing I knew, I was trying to figure out, wow, this is pretty cool. I wish I could do this kind of like time level. And so I started doing talent shows at school, and it was just an easy win. It was just so just easy. Just everything came easy. And finally, I entered a pageant, the Miss Black America pageant, and I ended up traveling to Europe to entertain the troops around the world. And that was like a really big deal. So when I got back, I started pursuing it as a career. And I moved to California at the expense, actually, of Red Fox, who had a guy in Europe who saw me perform and said, Red Fox is going to love you. And at that time, Sanford and Son was like the biggest television show ever at that particular time. So they flew me to L.A., and the story began. And Red Fox was my very first manager. Now, when I look back on that, I'm like, that is just so, that's so heavy. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people, you know, credit, you know, Red for what he's done to in comedy as well. I mean, he's kind of the guy that that a lot of black comedians looked up to back in the day. You know, he's done so much for giving you opportunities as well. I mean, yourself included, but other comedians as well, giving them opportunities as well. What did it mean, and what did Red mean to you as a kind of a mentor and a manager back in the day?
Wow, that's a great question, Mark. That's a great question. Red Fox was so big at the time that, honestly, and me being such a younger woman, I didn't even understand the magnitude of who I was dealing with. I mean, I just figured, you know, he's the star assassin son. They're going to put me on the show. And, you know, they signed me immediately because during that time, there just were no black female impressionists, period. There were so few comedians, I honestly never saw any black females. I'm sure there were some, but I just never ran into them in L.A. And so with him being my representative, first of all, he was such a serious, no-nonsense person. This guy who we laugh at and fall out and cracking up and hitting his side was so serious and such a no-nonsense person. It was like, he's just the same person that you see on TV or on the stage making people laugh. He was just incredible. He was all about business, all about business. So I'm going to be honest to say at the time, I didn't even realize the magnitude of that. It wasn't until years later when I started telling the story that I realized just how huge that was. That was a high-profile position that I was put in. And at that time, I didn't even understand it, and I guess that was my journey. You know, I wasn't supposed to understand. But it was. I look back now, and I think, my God, what a blessing. What a blessing.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, obviously there wasn't at the time very many black female comedians, you know, working at the time that you started out as well. And mm-hmm. that has seemed to progress to now where we're seeing a couple of them that are starting to make, they're starting to make waves a little bit as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that progression? Have you seen a progression that more female black comedians are starting to take the stage a little bit more often?
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, my goodness. As a matter of fact, I'm speaking, when I speak of the fact that there weren't that many, I'm speaking of the time period from like the late, I'll say the early 70s. Early 70s. I was around when the Comedy Store, I think they may have opened in the early mid 70s. I don't know if you're familiar with the Comedy Store, but it's like an iconic comedy club that anybody who's anybody in Los Angeles goes to perform. I mean, I used to, when I was out there in the 70s, Richard Pryor would come through at any given time. You see Bill Cosby, Mr. Fox, you know, Red Fox would come through. I remember meeting Jimmy Walker there some good times. I traveled at that time, and I'm going to get to the black female thing in just a moment. I just wanted to give you an idea of what it was like back then. There was Jay Leno. There was Robin Williams. David Letterman, these guys would come and frequent the club. They hadn't made it yet. They were still scratching the surface, just like me. We were looking for opportunities. And I always noticed that not only did I see so very few black women, I don't even remember seeing one, as I said earlier. I didn't even see hardly any white women, maybe one or two. And so as time progressed, as we moved into the 80s, I mean, I remember that Marsha Warfield came out on the scene, and she was just phenomenal. And then you had Shirley Hempel, who was also very funny. She did the television show What's Happening. And I also remember LaWanda Page, who was actually on Saturday and Sunday on Esther. And that's the extent of the black women I remember from back then. And as we moved into the 80s, I started seeing other black women coming on the surface, like Robin Montague, who did several movies. There was, you know, several black women, but not a lot. But now that we've surfaced up to the 2000s, there's like an unbelievable amount of black women who are incredibly gifted and talented and just so smart in their comedy that I'm overwhelmed with happiness to see it take a stand like that. Because back then, there was I had no friends. There was nobody I could say, meet me at the Comedy Store, or meet me at the Improv, or meet me. It was just me. There were hardly any, you know, there were black guys, but, you know, like I said, my buddies that I was in the comedy industry with was Jay Leno and David Letterman and Robin Williams, and along comes Rosie O'Donnell, and then there would be Elaine Boozler. So I was delighted to see that so many people had progressed into comedy and were bringing their gifts forward, especially black women. So, you know, you had your Hope Floods and Alicia Coopers and Lonnie Loves, and they're really doing their thing.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, isn't the Comedy Store where is Mitzi Shore's club down in L.A.?
Yes, exactly. As a matter of fact, in my book, I talk about Mitzi Shore was the person who the first time I went to the comedy store, when I got off stage, because they only gave you like a couple of minutes to show who you were. When I got off stage, she had someone to come and say she wanted to speak to me. And everybody thought that was just the biggest deal ever. If Missy Shore wants to see you, that's huge. I mean, she's just not going to pick anybody to speak to about what they do. And she called me over and she said she thought I had a good shot and that she wanted me to go out to her West Hollywood. They had another store in West Hollywood. I can't believe I remember all this stuff, but it was so fascinating, and I didn't realize how huge it was at the time. So, yeah, that's who runs the comedy store, Missy Shore.
Yeah, because I was going to mention that, you know, I think even at that time, there wasn't as many females running comedy clubs at all. And Missy was kind of a revolutionary in that fact. And, you know, and that obviously kind of would mean something to you as well to see a gal in a kind of a position of power when it comes to comedy and you know, kind of breaking a little bit of a barrier herself.
And, you know, again, Mark, I didn't understand how important that was back then because I didn't know that there were no other women running comedy clubs at the time. You know, here I am. I'm brand new in the business. My whole focus is trying to get on stage and perfect my craft and be seen by people and hopefully the right person will see me. It didn't even occur to me at that time that people were making history, Missy Shore included. I mean, I wasn't even thinking anything about that. It's like today, people are doing things and they don't know. Maybe 30 years, 34 years from now, people will be talking about how historic what it is that they did, and they don't even realize that it's historic. So it was when the TV shows and radio personalities started to call me and said, we want to talk to you, we understand that, you know, you were the first African-American female impressionist in this country. And I'm thinking, oh, wow. You know, I didn't even realize it like that. I knew for a long time I was the only black female doing that for a while. But now even the impressions are starting to come up. I've seen two or three other black female impressionists pop up. Now, I've also seen a few white female impressionists pop up as well. And all of them just warms my heart to see that they have taking what they do seriously, and they're using it for the betterment of entertainment, and I love it. I just love it.
Yeah, I know of two female impressionists that were on one on America's Got Talent. One of them I think was the year before, then one of them was this year. And
right.
I was very impressed with both of them.
Yes, I loved it when I saw both of them. It brought tears to my eyes. I said, you know, this is just awesome. The women are starting to come forward and do their thing. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to see, you know, I was like, I wanted to see them on SNL. They were so good. So hopefully they'll get to there someday. Let's talk a little bit about the Ollie Roast. How did that come about?
That's a good story too. I was living in New York City because I left LA. Both my parents died. And when my dad died, I wanted to be close to my mom. So I moved back to the East Coast, being in the entertainment industry, I moved up to New York, and I'm from Washington, D.C., so I could be close to home. And I read in the paper one day where they were roasting Muhammad Ali. And I'm like, oh, my God. And everybody that was anybody was going to be there at the legendary Apollo Theater. Richard Pryor was hosting the event. You had Duke Gregory. There were all these sports players and people in the know who were going to be roasters. For instance, Garrett Morris from Saturday Night Live. You had Dick Cavett, all these names of people who were going to roast the champ. And so I decided I had to be in that scene. So I said I was going to dress up like a black Ruth Bussey. Now, I don't know if you know who Ruth Bussey is, but Ruth Bussey was a famous character on a television program called Laughing. And it was the number one show in the country back during the late 70s. And Ruth Bussey was the character that every time any man got near, she took her bag and popped him upside his head. And so I was going to dress up. I loved Ruth Bussey. I loved her. I was going to dress up like a black one and go to the Ali roast and crash. That's the Oscar truth. That's what I was going to do. And come to find out, Richard Pryor was unable to host the roast. And they asked Dick Gregory to do it. But he didn't want to do it. He wanted to be on the panel of roasters. And somehow or another, Mark, my name, part of the somehow or another, is the girl that was Miss Black America the year that I was in the pageant, recommended that they hire me as the hostess. And they gave it a shot and hired me, and I could not believe it, that they gave me that job. And here I am on stage at the Apollo Theater with the incredible roast of Muhammad Ali. It was the roast of the century. Everybody, the place was packed. It was standing room only. You had people standing up and down on the side of the aisles. It was just incredible. And Garrett Morris, who was in the group at Saturday Night Live with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner and Jane Curtin and that whole crew, asked me if he could speak with me, and he said, I've never seen anybody do what you do. So I think Lorne Michaels would love you, and I'd like to introduce you to him. And he said, Saturday Night Live would love to have you. And I'm thinking, keep in mind, Saturday Night Live is only about 4 years old, so it wasn't the iconic, unbelievable television program that it is today. It was a great program. It was a hit. It was a major hit. So they took me over to NBC and introduced me to Mr. Michaels, who offered me a job as an associate writer, and the office flunky, by the way. I have to say that. And it was like magic. I mean, it was on the spot. They didn't even have, he had never even seen me perform, but he took Garrett's word. He took his word because he knew Garrett wouldn't bring him anything, I guess. This is what I'm guessing. That Garrett Morris was going to bring him the real deal. And so I got hired on the spot.
Okay, before we get into that, I did want to ask you one question. Was that the first time you ever performed at the Apollo Theater?
Was that the first time?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that was the first time and only time. That's the first time I ever performed there and the only time I ever performed there. Yes.
Well.
So.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, you hear so many comedians that, you know, I've always, you know, wanting to perform there or have performed there as well, in all that as well. So it's kind of one of those things that's kind of a turning point in a career if you play the Apollo Theater. So very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it like kind of hanging out back in the writer's room and being able to, see some of the people that were there, you know, really, you know, seriously writing for this upstart show named Saturday Night Live. What was it like, kind of the environment like in the early days?
I remember the first night that they sent the limousine for me to come to Saturday Night Live this one Saturday. I remember the star that night was Linda Ronstadt. And oftentimes when I'm on shows and I'm saying these names, it's kind of like, I hope people know who I'm talking about, because Linda Ronstadt was just awesome. She was just awesome. And she was the person who they had as their special guest that night. And I remember going over there, Mark, and being backstage, and I went back, and the first thing I saw was a door with John Belushi's name on it. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, it was like magic. Limousine picks me up, and at that time I was not accustomed to riding around in limousines like that. So, you know, they pick me up, they take me to NBC. I see one door that says John Belushi, then I see another one that says Jane Curtin, and then I see one that says Dan Aykroyd, and I'm back in the back, and they're telling me that I'm going to be assisting Linda Ronstadt, because I hadn't actually started writing or anything like that then. And so I was so overwhelmed, delighted and overwhelmed with just being there, because I've never done major television before. So it was a big deal. It was one of the most exciting times of my life. Not to mention I was trying to put together a television special myself, because I remember watching the Sonny and Cher show, and I wanted to have my own television show, you know, my own talk show, and just all kinds of dreams. Just all kinds of dreams. But at that time, being a Black female comedian, and I don't know how to say this properly because I don't really say this all the time, but at that time they weren't really looking for somebody like me in terms of looks. They had Moms Mabley, then they had LaWanda Page, and then they had somebody coming out just totally on another realm. I'm just keeping it, like a few people have written books about it, and you know, they say Sylvia may have been a little bit ahead of her time or whatever, so. Yeah, it was truly, truly an exciting time in my life. Just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, seeing women like Gilda Radner or Jane Curtin that were, you know, they were actually making a little bit of strides themselves as female comedians on Saturday Night Live. And again, what does that kind of mean to you that, you know, to be able to work with those two?
Well, you know, again, keep in mind that at that time, it wasn't a big, nobody was talking about females doing, you know, it wasn't until, I would say, the late 80s, early 90s, if I remember correctly, this whole female thing being on television became such a big deal. It was like they were on the show. Now, the word was that John Belushi didn't think women were funny. That's just the word. I'm not saying that that's what it was. That was the word that was out there at the time. So it was kind of interesting that we weren't even kind of like focusing on women being on the show. Now, if you ask me that today, I look back and since you've asked me that today, I look back and I think about, wow, these two, Jane Curtin and Gilda Radner, also had to have a fight. They were up against a fight during that time, and people didn't even know or understand or realize what it was they had to go through in order to earn and maintain their respect as female comics, black or white. You know what I'm saying? It was a time where they had to really prove and produce top-of-the-line excellence in order to be recognized, accepted, and respected for what they did. So for Jane and Gilda, I tip my hat, and I thank them both. I thank them for their hard work and their perseverance in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, Jane's done a lot since then. I mean, she's done a lot of shows, all that as well, and she's had a really outstanding career. And Gilda, I mean, I think she's an absolute legend in women's comedy. Mm-hmm. There's very, very few comedians that wouldn't tip their hats to Gilda and how much she's done and how funny she was when she was there as well. And we lost her way too soon, I felt too. So it was, you know, it's just unbelievable to be able to say that as well. Speaking of which, I know you had the great opportunity to tour with Whitney Houston, at a point in time. Tell us a little bit about that, being able to open up for Whitney.
You know, Mark, that was, oh my God, man, you talk about excited. Whitney was, at that time, it was 1986, and she was one of the biggest acts in the world. I mean, she was just all of that. And she was performing in Washington, D.C., and a colleague, a friend of mine, was supposed to open for her on that Friday night, but he thought the show was Saturday. How lucky for me, because when he didn't show up, 10 minutes before the show started, the promoters called and said, Sylvia, we've got Whitney Houston in town, and we need an opening act. Can you get down here and open for her? Show starts at 8 o'clock. The sooner you get here, we'll even give you a bonus that you can get here in a respectable amount of time. I was taking out rollers in my hair in the taxi cab headed to the venue, and when I walked on stage, it was 8:05. And I got like 3 standing ovations. And when Whitney was, you know, the first thing she said was, we're going on tour and we're going to take you with us. And I was like, oh my God. Now that was kind of, I understood the hugeness of that, but not to the effect that I do now, you know, now that she's become this legend and icon and she's gone. But when the tour started, they hadn't called me. They used the winner from Star Search. And I was devastated because I said, well, they said that they would take me. But they didn't. And for whatever reason, after I realized that I wasn't on the tour, I got a phone call. And they said, can you be in New York? Because I was in D.C. Can you be in New York? Whitney wants you on the tour. And when I got there, whoever the person was that was opening for her was gone. And it was just up to. I opened the show. She closed the show. We did 28 cities. So that was a major, major, major deal for me. That woman treated me so wonderful while I was on the road with her. And she gave me that opportunity itself opened up so many doors and left me with so many wonderful memories that I dedicated 2 chapters in my book to Whitney, explaining how I met her, what happened the first time I met her, and then I put a different chapter of us while we were on tour, some of the things that happened while we were on tour. And I never got a chance to share it with her because we launched the book in October the year before she died. She died that February, and we had just launched, and I never got a chance to call her and say, I was doing so many book signings and so forth that I figured by the time I got settled, we could get together, and I could share with her the two chapters that I had in the book about her, and it just never happened. And I can't tell you the level of devastation that went through me when she died. It was just sad.
Yeah, I mean, again, another person that died way too soon, and she's, you know, she's one of those icons that everybody's going to remember, you know, for years to come as well. She's one of the primary divas of this generation. So, yeah, she will be missed. You know, talk a little bit about right now. I mean, obviously, you know, you've been in the business a very, very long time, and you know, you're going back on stage from time to time as well.
Mm-hmm.
How has it been kind of adapting to some of the new faces out there right now? Because I know you do a little Wendy Williams now. You got Whoopi out there now too. But how has it been to kind of update your act a little bit with about different new characters and voices?
Well, you know, the people that I do now as opposed to the people I did back in the day, it's just totally different. I mean, back in the day, I was doing Joan Rivers. I was doing Cher. I was doing Jane Hathaway from the Beverly Hillbillies. I was doing Lily Tomlin. You know, so with all of the new personalities that are coming up, that have come up today, you know, I'm able to bring Michelle Obama to life. I'm able to bring a different side of Wendy Williams and Whoopi Goldberg and some of the newer. I'm just adding Rihanna and Nicki Minaj to my repertoire and Fantasia, Marino, and so I just recently added Britney Spears, and it's been such a change and such a challenge because, of course, back then, those names that I just named, we didn't have them back then in the day. But the names that we did have were so, I mean, Cheryl is, people still love Cher. They love Cher with everything. And they, you know, Joan Rivers is still an icon. She's just on everybody's television in America. So even when I bring them back, it's okay because people still love those characters. But it has been a totally different change, especially with the way audiences come out now. There's so many open mic clubs, so many nightclubs, there's so many comedy clubs. It's so different than what it was back in the day. I remember at home in D.C., there were only two comedy clubs, two. There was a place called Robin's, and then there was a place called the Comedy Cafe. And if you weren't working in one of those clubs, it was just too bad. You just didn't get on. And when the country started to become saturated with comics, they got smart. Comics got smart. They started opening their own rooms. They started doing their own comedy shows. They started having their own open mic. So today, you can just get up if you decide you want to be a comic and go to an open mic at almost any business corner where there are clubs and public scenes. It's changed. It's incredibly changed.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I talk to a lot of comedians about, you know, the changes that happened in the new century. There's a lot more social media. There's a lot more ways for you to reach out to,
yes,
reach out to club promoters. Because back in the day, you may have had to send a tape recording or have to send a videotape to the club owners. But nowadays, you can just email them and say, "Here's my stuff. Here's a link to my video," and you get to you get to do it as well. So there's more opportunities for you to get your name out there.
Then, you know, you didn't have any of that. It was, I remember trudging up and down the road to 4 and 5 clubs a night in New York and in L.A. In L.A., I didn't even have a car, so to get around, it was just crazy. But in New York, I could walk. But I remember there was no, you have to, it's just a totally different world. It's a totally different world. There were no emails. There was no cell phone to call and find out who's doing what. And there was no, you have to use the phone. You have to use a public telephone to call. There was none of that. So it's a lot different, and a lot of people are able to solicit fans and social network opportunities. That's way different. We had 3 networks back in the day. If you appeared on one of those networks, you were doing something. Oh, yeah, you were doing something. So that was
yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, there's more opportunities for comedians to be able to shine a little bit more, and there's a little bit more competition out there. But But you know, I think that you know it's a great time to be a comedian right now, and you know, you don't have to be in it's evolved so much that you don't have to be in one. You don't have to be kind of, you know, suited into one little kind of form. There's just so many variety, and people can relate to different kinds of variety of comedy as well. So I think it's a really good time to be a comedian just overall. Another thing, I needed to congratulate you on the National Living on Laughter Gospel Comedy Lifetime Achievement Award. I know that's more than well deserved. So great to be able to see that as well. And you guys can check out SylviaTraymore.com. And then I believe the book, is the book out on Amazon at all?
Yes, it is. Amazon.com. Or you can order it off go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was going to say, yeah. Yeah, you definitely got to check it out. And you said you're on your website as well, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so SylviaTraymore.com as well. You guys can check out the book and buy it. I highly recommend you do so as well. Any upcoming shows coming up for you, Sylvia?
I have a couple shows that I'm so happy to say they're sold out already. So that's been like a big, I'm working on a play. I did my premiere play. It's called A Come See About Me, a fan Diana Ross story. And we're doing 30 cities. We haven't put the dates together with the cities, but I'd be happy to send you the information when we're done and give you the dates and so forth.
Well, I really hope that you have one of those dates ink marks for here in Vegas, because I'd be very interested to see that, and I'm pretty sure a bunch of the people that listen by my listeners would definitely love to see that as well. So fingers crossed for you able to book a date here in Vegas.
Okay, I would love to. I would just love it.
I also want to mention you can also find Sylvia on Twitter at Sylvia T. Morrison on Twitter, and also on Facebook. So definitely, definitely check her out there as well. And I'm pretty sure she'll be posting those dates on both of those as well. Anything else you want to add?
I think that's it. Again, the book is almost there, almost. The Many Faces of Sylvia Traymore Morrison. And I'm delighted that you had me on your show. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been an absolute delight, and we could have went on for another half an hour talking a little bit as well. So hopefully, like I said, well, if you book a gig here in Vegas, I definitely will try to get you back on the show again, and we can definitely dive in a little bit more to some of your story, because there's a lot more questions I have. So best of luck to you coming up on this new tour, and I really look forward to being able to talk to you again.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
No problem, and we'll talk to you soon, Sylvia.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Morrison's book, Almost There, is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Speaking of SNL, next Thursday we throw back to March 3rd, 2008, and our talk with Eric Bloom of Blue Oyster Cult, who tells us about the famous cowbell sketch on SNL. We also talk to him about his writing of music and Bloom's artistic guitars. There's no live show Monday, as I'll be heading back from Portland, and we'll hopefully have some great interviews in the coming weeks. Check out our website, VegasPodcasting.com, for archives of our recent interviews. Also check us out on Twitter at SWIV, at SWIV, and somewhere in Vegas on Facebook. We'll see you next week.